I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The Shafia murders in 2009, where four women were pulled out of the Rideau Canal in Kingston, Ontario, shocked and horrified a nation and beyond. It taught us a lot about honor killings, religion, and the clash between Canadian values and the justice system, and that of what my guest now calls ancient concepts of male power and entitlement. Paul Schliessman is a reporter with the Kingston Whig Standard and has been covering the Shafia murders and the subsequent trial. He's now written a new book, Honor on Trial, The Shafia Murders and the Culture of Honor Killings. It's a cogent overview of the murder, who the four women were, the circumstances that they found themselves in, and the three people who were found guilty of the murders under the guise of honor killing. I'll get Mr. Schliessman to tell us about the concept of honor killings, the Shafia family, and what this spectacle has enlightened about our modern times and our Canada. In January 2012, Mohammed Shafia and his second wife, Touba Yahya, and their son Hamid were found guilty of murdering Shafia sisters Zainab, Shahar, and Giti, who were 19, 17, and 13. Also murdered was Mr. Shafia's first wife, Rona Muhammad. Mr. Shafia led a polygamous household. This is a really good book, reading like a novel in some parts, and an important one and about this important story. Published by FitzHenry and Whiteside, visit fitzhenry.ca for more information. Please welcome to the Plant Online program from Kingston, Ontario, Paul Schliessman. Mr. Schliessman, good morning.
Hi, nice to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. So you've covered this story, covered this case right from the beginning when the car was found in the lock, is that right?
Just about from the beginning, yeah. It was within a month or so that I ended up on the story. An interesting sideline to this that not too many people know it, but my oldest son was working as a student on the lock station that day when the car was found in the water. And they let the students go home early that day, but that was when I got one of the first inklings about how serious it was, the situation there at the Kingston Mills lock station.
To this day, is there anyone who saw the car go into the water?
No. There is not one witness to this crime. There was... At the preliminary hearing for the trial, police had a witness, a young boy, who may have been a sleepwalker or an insomniac child, actually, and may have seen or heard something, but he was never called to trial, so there were no direct witnesses to the event.
So with your book, I mean, it's difficult to find an entry point into how we start the conversation. So let's just start at the beginning. What brought the Shafias to Canada?
They were a family that had traveled the world a little bit. Father was a businessman, pretty successful. The Shafias had some family already in Montreal, so they decided to come here in 06, 07. And began that process, and they arrived and set up a house, and the father established himself pretty quickly as an importer-exporter, bought himself a $2 million shopping mall in Montreal, and his eldest son, who was also involved in the crimes, Hamed, helped him run those businesses.
Were any of their, I guess none of their kids were born here, right?
No, none of them were born in Canada.
Yeah. Now he was married in the, I guess it was in the, was it in the early 80s to Rona?
Yes, and this was one of the mysteries of the whole situation. When the world first started to hear about the Shafias after the car was found and all the attention was paid on them, they were trying to claim that this was an accident of misadventure, that Rona and the three girls had taken the car at night and gone off in it, and, you know, joyriding and ended up dying in the canal. But it soon came out that she was, in fact, his first wife. And this is going back to the 1980s, and the problem was that the couple was unable to have children. So it was not uncommon and somewhat customary in Afghanistan at the time that a man, you know, could take a second wife on those grounds, and that's what he did. In fact, we ended up running pictures at the Whig Standard of the marriage to Tuba, who was the second wife, with Rona right there at their side, involved in the wedding pictures.
Now, when they lived in Montreal, did they? She lived with them, obviously, right? They all lived in one big house.
Yeah, she kind of followed them around the world. There are issues at different times with her being able to get access to, you know, landed immigrant status. But there were several months when she was left in Europe, and the family had set up in Montreal, and then they brought her along later on. But that was one of the really troubling points of issue in this whole case, was that they held that over Rona's head, and they kept tight control of her visa,
yeah,
and all the process that might have enabled her to get landed immigrant status here in Canada.
Yeah. So when they were in Montreal, did people know that he was a polygamist, that he had two wives?
No. It was a strange line of questioning sometimes at the trial too. Like, you know, who knew what about Rona? The family didn't have a very wide network of friends. There was some family. Now, the family would have known the status of it, but the children, you know, considered her an aunt in public, or they would call her Mother Rona. And there was always that, it wasn't quite clear exactly who she was. The police and social workers would have had contact with her in the household at times, but nobody really knew who she was. She was basically listed as a family member or a cousin with Canadian immigration, and that she was coming over to help the parents take care of the children, as sort of a glorified domestic.
Yeah, and she tried to get away a number of times, right?
That was a really sad and tragic part of the story, too. There was clearly physical and emotional abuse taking place in the home, and she would walk the streets of Montreal all day long, rain or snow, just to get out of that house. And she had she developed in the last year of her life a telephone long-distance correspondence with a woman who was sort of a relative of hers down in the United States, who she told about all her troubles, and this woman was trying to help her seek out assistance in Montreal, you know, to get to authorities, to get to a church, to get to somebody and get some assistance, but it never worked out for Rona.
What I remember about the trial, and I didn't follow it, certainly not as much as you did, covering the story, but, you know, if you were in this country at the time, you could not help but follow this case or read about it or see it on television. But what I remember the most was the outrage and the dismay from a lot of people, you know, about the horrific nature of the crime and, for lack of a better word, the backwardness of it all. What was the defense of the Shafias in terms of how their daughters were treated and I guess subsequent the murder? I mean, they claimed that Mr. Shafia claims that he had nothing to do with this, that he was innocent. Is that correct?
They claim their innocence right down to being sentenced, basically.
Yeah.
There was denial all the way along, and this is the incredible part of the story that I hope I was able to convey in the book effectively, is the way that, you know, the family was isolated, the way there was so much trouble in the home. There was contact at several times, you know, with the school authorities, with social workers, with police. Yet nobody seemed to be reading the signs here. And it enabled all of this isolation, enabled Muhammad and Tuba, his wife, and his son Hamed, to hatch this plot, and that was, you know, subsequently uncovered in hindsight by the police, who Kingston police pieced this whole thing together using cell phone records and computer traces on their, on their laptop. And, you know, finally they were able to put it all together, but it took a lot of legwork. And then the realization that this was a family that had been in total crisis, and there was no way that they were getting any outside help, and the result was just awful. You know, four deaths, just incredible.
So Mohammed Shafia, his I guess one of the main arguments in terms of his innocence is that his daughters brought him a dishonor, brought him shame. And it had to do with the fact that they were acting sort of in a Western way. I mean, is that pretty much? I mean, to simplify his point of view, is that what he's saying?
That's basically what he was saying. Well, although it's such a complex and mysterious plot that when they police wiretapped them after the murders had taken place, after the deaths had taken place, and police planted wiretaps and heard him say all kinds of awful things about his daughters, calling them whores, and exhorting the devil to come and, defecate on their graves. Mm-hmm. And so he was saying that he never really learned about all the things that they were doing, about having boyfriends and seeing the boyfriends on the side, and the way they were actually dressing until after they were dead, when he saw pictures in a photo album.
Yeah.
But it seemed clear from these wiretaps that he had knowledge of what they were doing. And it became, I think, looking at it in hindsight, it was like this perfect storm where, this family had old-fashioned ideas about how girls should be in society. And when they got to Canada, they found our social values completely different. You know, these kids were out there trying to interact and be social and just be normal kids. And the parents were realizing, oh my goodness, we've got 16, 17, 18, 19-year-olds here, and we can't seem to control this. And their reaction was to be very cruel and isolating and in the end, resort to the ultimate punishment.
So the term honor killing, I mean, that's, I guess, one of the first times that I've heard of it, certainly used in this country, in this context, I should say. Does he use that term himself?
No, there was a denial. In fact, when the wife, Tuba, got on the stand, she said she'd never heard of the term honor killing in her life, even though it's a practice, that's not uncommon in a lot of Mideastern countries. It's quite a debate about that term. A lot of people in the Muslim community don't like it because it puts a label on something that they feel is unfair, and that it's too often, and I might say incorrectly, related to the Muslim religion. It's a lot of experts who have looked at this phenomenon say yes, that there is such a thing as honor killing, that it's a patriarchal based, it's based on the head of the household usually preserving his honor because he feels that he's being shamed by, the women, mostly the women in the family. But there is an acknowledgement that it exists, and that also in the Mideastern context, it often involves the women, like the mother of the household can become directly involved in the crime, and that is what happened in the Shafia case. The mother was, an accomplice, at least.
Now, there are other children, right? The Shafias had other children other than the three daughters that were murdered, right?
That's right.
I guess early on, the judge said that there's a ban in terms of publicizing their names or where they are today. Is that correct?
That's right. They cannot be identified. But one of them, a son who would have been, in the middle of the pack of the seven children, did come and testify, and so that we know that they are out there. But no, we're not allowed to talk about them directly or identify them directly.
I remember during the course of the trial, I remember seeing Christy Blatchford on Sun News. I guess she was she covered the trial quite regularly, hadn't she?
Yep. She was part of the media pack there for sure.
Yeah, and I remember she said on Sun News at the time that one of the reasons why warning signs weren't heeded was because in this country, at least, there is this sort of she termed it as a sort of deference to other cultures and other I guess customs in an effort to not impose, say, whatever Canadian values there might be in this country. And so that was the cause of say, the social assistance system failing and the sort. Did you find that observation of hers is correct?
Well, when we were covering the trial, yes, there was that debate swirling all around about what do you call it, how do you identify it. The Crown and the police were very clear about this up front. They tried to establish that the honor killing concept was the motive and probably the main motive behind the murders. And they set out to prove that. And there are a number of times when we hear on the wiretaps, we hear Shafia talk about his honor being lost and shamed. And it was from his own mouth, from his own words, that they were able to piece this together to use that as motive. You don't have to establish motive in a murder case, but it certainly helps when you have a jury of 12 people sitting here who aren't familiar with that kind of concept. It gives them a framework to work in. And I think, for the most part, it was generally accepted and acknowledged, and I don't think the Crown or the police had to play around with it. They didn't have to deny any of that. It was used quite openly, and I think it came to be accepted in this case that this is what it was. It was an honor killing.
And so there were, there was a breakdown in terms of say, police and as well as sort of the schools and the social agencies involved, information wasn't shared in terms of, say, the problems that were going on in the house.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Did you find that today immigrant families who are facing similar challenges, that they get the assistance that they need in terms of, say, even just an agency or a police detachment understanding the sort of cultural challenges?
The spring after the ruling, this past spring, the Prime Minister went to Montreal. And he appeared in Montreal with an agency that helps immigrant families cope with situations like that, basically a social work agency, and gave them a fair chunk of money to come up with something to, some protocol. And I spoke to the director of that organization, and she said, you know, this is like all the other waves of immigration that we've had in Canada, you know, throughout our history. There's an isolation that occurs when people come over. They tend to group up. Women get lost in the shuffle. Often it's the men who are out working. And the kids who are, you know, become the translators. You know, it's been lived out for generations and generations. And that there's this specific undercurrent here, a deadly kind of undercurrent, that can pop up, and that's what they're going to start paying attention to now, when it comes to Middle Eastern immigration. It's not unusual. You know, it's domestic violence, isn't it, at the root of it? But it has a different kind of twist to it here.
And I mean, you're a reporter, so, I mean, it doesn't matter what your opinion is, but in terms of your observations, certainly looking at this trial, and looking at the country, our Canadian culture in general, do you think that because there was a clash of societal values here, and do you think down the line, in the future, that say we can coexist in this country, say with whatever Canadian values are, as well as values say that are imported here?
I'm really impressed and really proud of our societal reaction to this case. There's been no hysteria. There's been good discussion. You know, there are always people who try to whip something up along racial lines or religious lines, and it's not necessarily the case. The people who are going to look at this, I believe, are going to say it's a case of isolation. It's a case of breaking down barriers, language barriers, so that people, become full citizens. They get out in the mix. And in doing so, you don't allow this sort of thing to happen behind closed doors. Everybody knows. Like, what they say is when people come to Canada, when they immigrate to Canada, we should be telling them exactly what the story is here. These are the values that you have to live up to, and you can't impose values that put people's lives at risk or that are abusive, whether physically or emotionally in any way. And I think we'll get there. I think we can do that, yes.
Well, what sort of toll has covering this story taken on you? And how did you find the experience of writing this book afterwards?
I found there was a bit of a kickback of sorts. When you cover a trial like that one, it was 3 months. It was very intensive, and it was watched around the world.
Yeah.
And you kind of put your head down, right, as a reporter, and you kind of bang out the stories every day. And then when I was asked by FitzHenry Whiteside to write the book and got down to it this past winter and spring, when I reread the testimony and what happened, it was quite powerful. It's disturbing. At the time of the trial, my own daughter was 16, 17 years old. She followed it with great interest, and I noticed a lot of kids in the Kingston area were reading the stories as well. I think it had an impact on everybody. We're trying to figure out what this was about, and I think in writing the book, it was a powerful experience again to go over all of that and to have the time to sit there and really think about it. And I'm hoping that if people pick up the book and look through it, that this is where it puts the whole story together.
Mm-hmm.
and tells the story, and specifically for the four women who died. They have to be remembered, and if we forget what happened to them, then really it's all in vain, isn't it?
Indeed. Your publisher, I read somewhere that she wanted to publish this book. She wanted this book out there, their stories out there. I mean, this book is really for everyone, isn't it? For young readers as well.
Yeah, it is. It's, as I say, it's young people really tuned into this. I've raised three kids who are now in university. And I know it's tough. There's always a clash between parents, and there's a clash of societal values, and all those things are out there. And it's tough for even those of us who've grown up in this culture to always understand what our kids are doing. This family was totally lost. They lost direction somehow. And that's something that we can't allow to happen anymore. The kids need to be helped. The parents need to be helped. We have to pay attention. We're a country of immigration, and we welcome it. But if we're going to welcome it, we have to, pay attention to these details as well.
Paul, this is a good book. Congratulations on it, and best of luck with it.
So thanks very much. Great talking to you.
You're very welcome. The book is called Honor on Trial, The Shafia Murders and the Culture of Honor Killings. FitzHenry and Whiteside is the publisher. Visit FitzHenry.ca for information on the book. It's author Paul Schliessman on the line from Kingston, Ontario in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plato.